the social self, what it is, what it isn't, how to work with it from a Buddhist perspective, what the Buddha talked about in relation to the social personalities that we put out for other people to see, what it can provide us with, what it can't provide us with, how it can bring us suffering and how it could bring us happiness. So the self is, or what we call our, you know, the self that other people know, the social presentation we make of ourselves, is, of course, constructed of a lot of different things. The clothing we wear, physical attributes, it can be makeup and haircuts, it can be more, importantly, it can be our judgments, opinions, views, our the statements we make, the all the way down to the way we think of ourselves in relation to other people. It actually, there's a lot of study of the social mask. It falls under the rubric of not only sociology, but psychology, learning theory. One of my favorites was a Russian child psychologist named Lev Vygotsky, who died when he was 32. But he did some amazing research back in the 1930s about how children develop. And it goes all the way through wonderful theorists like Bourdieu and Dawkins. Basically, what it boils down to is that human beings have mirror genes, which allow us to not only empathize with other people, but it allows us to see what other people are doing and imitate. The human mind is largely an imitation machine. I'll give you an example. When I was a kid, I was not good, particularly any good at sports. I'm gangly and not particularly strong or coordinated. And I make up for that by running very slowly. So, and people, when I'm jumping, can't even tell. So kids that were particularly financially well born into a lot of comfort, I was, you know, wasn't anything remarkable there. So I wasn't particularly good in math, didn't hang out with the kids that were... math. not in the chess club. So I wound up with the, well, let's face it, the druggies, the hard, the, you go where it's possible. And, at my time, this was like the middle to later 70s, there was a great transition from heavy metal to punk, and so I sort of straddled both. And, you know, when you find a group of people that will accept you, we begin to imitate things that we see get us accepted and noticed and approved of, because our social mask is based on survival. That's what we are rewarded for. That's what the brain is set up to help us to survive. And we are rewarded for when we say things and do things and present ourselves in ways that get acceptance and approval, or at least recognition from other people. Even negative attention can get can release reward transmitters like dopamine. Mm-hmm. So we're looking for some kind of positioning. And that's actually what Bourdieu, the great French philosopher, determined with his wonderful book, Distinction, that virtually all of our tastes, judgments, opinions, views, movies we like, music we listen to, furniture we buy, clothes we wear, it's all strategy, trying to find a way to gain acceptance and a place in the world that. And what's wonderful is he discovered when he followed people over time that are the things that we like change with the groups we follow if the group's tastes change. For example, as I was talking about yesterday, when I was a young guy and punk was new, everybody had to wear black jackets and little skinny ties and white shirts. We all looked like waiters walking around. It was a bizarre look. I don't remember the way the Knack used to look. I don't want to make a guitar. I didn't like the Knack. It's not like I ever played air guitar to the Knack, but that was an indication to you that they were bands, in case you're wondering, you know, what that means. But then, like, tastes change, and we went from that to completely different looks. Now, when you look at what the way punks dress now sort of looks like the way hippies did back in the 70s. It's sort of come 180 degrees. So, you know, the way we cut our hair, the things we like, what we listen to, the ideas we espouse, they change over time, given what we think will, or unconsciously believe will make us accepted and will get us approval. So the Buddha said, in the Dhammapada, the Buddha said that the big issue is he who mistakes his essence for what is not his essence and what is not his essence for his essence winds up suffering. Which means the Buddha's not saying we get rid of the social mask that we have. Oh, I want to be a funny person. I want to be the smart guy. I want to be the you know, decision maker. I want to be this, I want to be that. The idea that we can shred and just simply drop are the social identities that we've developed is a myth. We're too invested in it. It's too already part of the process of being a human being. But the Buddha does talk quite a bit about, in fact, you wouldn't want to be able to drop it anyway. We need to have a conventional identity that we can use to a certain degree to not only develop careers and to develop, you know, friendships with certain groups. We need to be able to, you know, present to a certain degree a consistent identity to other people so that they know what they can turn to us for. It's part of the social contract to a certain degree. And you would want to be able to go to a psychiatrist who thought of him or herself as a healing person. You wouldn't want to go to a therapist who said, oh, I'm really just, this is a social mask. I'm really not involved with this. It's just something that I do, but I just picked this up simply as a strategy because my parents rewarded me and the people around me rewarded me for being in this career, but I really don't, I don't really care that much. So that's not what you would gravitate towards. So to a certain degree, we want to have a certain amount of investment in the social identity we put out. We can't shred it or shed it or drop it. But what we can do is, first of all, we can tell apart that these opinions and views, these things that we've developed likes and dislikes over the years, the kinds of movies we like, the kinds of music we like, the kind of books we read, the kind of all the way down the line. We can realize that at heart there's stuff that we picked up unconsciously so that we could have a role in the world, which means we don't get so upset when people like different things. That, for me, was a long lesson in coming. I really couldn't understand it if you didn't like the same bands when I was very young. You know, when you, if you didn't like the movies I liked or the things I liked, I found it very difficult. So it was really, it came as a great relief to realize that these likes and dislikes were not, are not absolutes, of course. They're just things that I have over time grown to appreciate. But given a different set of circumstances, I could have, instead of being really into the Cro-Mags and Meshuggah, I could have been into Cat Stevens. It's unlikely, but it could have happened. I could have been listening to that. I'm opening my mind to that idea. So, so you get the idea. We do tend to get bent out of shape. And this not only is limited to cultural capital, it also expands into ideas and to concepts and to politics and all the way down the line. It's really discouraging how in our culture open political discussion has become so degraded. I remember when I was a kid, I used to love to turn on William F. Buckley and to argue with him, but I never expected it to degenerate into now what sounds like people calling for open warfare on people they disagree with. This shows that we have a tendency to forget that, by and large, all of the things that we've put out in the world are basically just ways that we've socialized ourselves to get acceptance. So the good news is that, first of all, the Buddha talked about using the social self strategically rather than be completely unaware of the personas that we're putting out there. We all like to, in a certain way, culturally, we tend to think it's great that we're, when we're unconscious, we think that somebody who's unaware of the mask that we're putting out or the roles that we're adopting amongst friends, they think that's natural. And that somebody who's like a Lady Gaga, I was told to use that yesterday. I used David Bowie yesterday, and people didn't know David Bowie. I mean, they knew him, but they just knew him from modern dance. They didn't know him from Ziggy to Aladdin Sane. He's known for changing his persona skillfully as a tactic. Nobody got it. So I have to stay modern. I have to stay up with it. I have to keep, I got to keep my ear to the ground. My cultural references are sagging. I'm falling behind. The kids are up to new things. I'm not keeping track. So, yes. So apparently Lady Gaga changes. So the thing is to, in a certain way, you know, there's a lot to be learned from seeing somebody that is, even though she's simply doing it to make money and to, I gather, to be popular, but or to a certain degree to shock, there is also a way to use the personas that we put out in a strategic way that will encourage us to do things that we want to do, accomplish things we want to accomplish. For example, rather, when I was a kid, I was such, and it hasn't shaken off to such a great degree, but to somewhat of a degree, I was like, I wanted to be the biggest know-it-all in music and film, and I had opinions on everything. And I realized over time that that's not anything that I really want to or care to put any effort into now. I want to put my efforts into putting myself out socially as someone who likes to talk about spiritual issues. And especially I like to take the teachings of the Buddha and make it easy for people to relate to. And so it's a strategy that a lot of the ways that I present myself and a lot of the ways that I'm known. And I espouse that because I'm going to have an identity and I'd rather take ownership of it and use it in a way that will bring me peace of mind and a sense of esteem for what I'm doing, rather than simply just allow my likes and dislikes that are completely so often arbitrary to be what I'm known by. There's nothing more tiresome than me drunk talking about how great Withnail and I is, if you know the movie. It's such a tedious experience. And that's who I was for, you know, in my 20s. Thankfully, decades have passed. And so you can take ownership. We can stretch. We can find things that we truly feel comfortable with, and we can begin to see how malleable the roles we play with other people are. We don't have to feel trapped or condemned to personas that we adopted when we were teenagers. I no longer, even though I'm still not remotely athletic, I've picked up at a very late age, I just learned to swim. I learned to skateboard, which was humiliating. All of it. You should have seen me teaching myself to swim in a pool surrounded by all these retirees in Central America. I looked like a drowning turtle. But, you know, we don't have to be trapped by these things. We can stretch. To a certain degree, there's certain areas that we can't stretch into, and it's good to recognize that. As you know, much as there's certain kind of things that I would love to be able to do, but they're unrealistic. There's certain things that I can do that are stretched. There's certain things that come very easily. I can pick up certain things quickly. Other things, it takes a lot of effort. But it's good to examine and explore. So that once we explore how much we can shift our the actions, likes, the way we present ourselves, the things that we do as hobbies, all these things, we can begin to then mold a interpersonal presentation that's strategic. We can think of ourselves as healers or artists, or we can think of ourselves as meditators or spiritual people or as, you know, people who love the outdoors or whatever. And it's really important not to get trapped in this idea of, oh, I can't do that, or I'm not good at that, or I'm incapable of that. Because unfortunately, it makes basically our lives a fait accompli to, again, personas and things that we adopted very, very young when we thought we could only survive if we were accepted by a very narrow group of people. But now that we're older, we're less at risk. When you're ostracized when you're a kid, it can be the end of the world. As an adult, hopefully it won't be the end of the world if a few people raise eyebrows because you're trying out something new. If it does raise eyebrows, that's good. I encourage you to do it. So, but the Buddha said that again, that when we mistake the external for the internal, that causes problems. If I really, over the years, think of myself as a musician, or a creative person, or a smart person, or this person, or that person, if I attach to that identity, then it will surely suck when the time comes for me to have to let go a little bit, or on days when I'm stuck and I can't do it. There's nothing more painful than, if you're a writer, having a writer's block. Because it feels like the entire identity has been stripped away. So if we attach to this idea, I am the writer, or I am the healer, and we're not particularly, we wake up on Tuesday and we don't really give a fuck about healing anyone. Or if we, you know, we wake up and we don't want to be creative, or we wake up and we just don't want to be ourselves that day. That's a it's important not to latch on to these things so that it causes suffering when we can't do it. Also, the more we latch on to it when other people don't appreciate our art. If I think I'm an artist and somebody doesn't like my painting, it's going to suck. If I think I'm a writer and nobody publishes me, it's going to really bite. If I think I'm, a loving person or somebody who heals and I'm working with somebody that doesn't seem to get any better, that's going to suck. So these identities, while they can spur us on to strategic and good, solid, healthy actions, if I attach to them, if I fully think that's deeply who I am at my core, then it's going to really hurt when I get criticism, rejection, which we all get. I mean, imagine some of the most... Look, Kafka didn't, I think, see anything published when he was alive. So it's entirely possible to be terrific at something and get absolutely no recognition. So the more we latch on to these identities, the more we're setting ourselves up. So we do it, but we don't fully buy into this is who I am. So that leaves us with where do I find this sense of a core? If I have this skillful social identity that spurs me on to do creative or healthy or worthwhile actions, but that's not where I'm going to find something that's real, that is lasting, where do I find it? And this is one of the reasons why we meditate. It's when we get to a point where we can put down the narratives and the stories we've built up about ourselves and we carry around those little inner biographies or autobiographies. You know you have them. Don't look confused. I don't know what he's talking about. We all have our little stories about ourselves, which we use to develop a sense of security in the idea that there's something about us that lasts. And we really cling onto them, and we begin to suffer later on in life when those things that we identify with begin to get stripped away. My dad always thought of himself as a very independent, self-sufficient guy, and when he got to a point in life where he had to be taken care of, it was really so much suffering because it was so deeply embedded. So when we're in meditation, we let go of these stories and we go for more of a felt idea that transcends the thoughts, that's left over beyond the ideas and concepts and even the feelings and the tendencies that we have. We might think of ourselves as, oh, I'm a happy person or a sad person. I'm an angry person. I'm a numb person. But anything that we carry around, these still are concepts, and we let them go. And we look for what I call more of an emergent truth, which is after we've gone through experiences in our lives, once the experiences have settled, there becomes a feeling of what it all meant. And that feeling doesn't fit into a concept that we can tell people. It becomes something that we've experienced that has a meaning that resonates, but it's not something that fits easy into a story. For example, the period of time when I, almost 20 years ago, got sober, the stuff that was going on then was very painful for me. And I thought, oh, this is just horrible, this point in my life. I'll be so glad when it's over. But then later on, after the dust settled, an entirely new perspective arose from that period. And I can't translate it that easily. It's one of a sense of gratitude that it happened so that I could see clearly the damage that I was doing to myself and the people who loved me and who were with me. So that emergent truth is something that doesn't arise, though, in the narratives we carry around. It's something that arises as a feeling afterwards as we look back or as we reflect on things from a different perspective. It's not a story that's very interesting from a concept or a telling, but it's something that resonates very importantly to me. The things that matter in my life, the experiences I've been through, the things that I've managed to achieve, I don't talk about them. I don't carry them as a story in my head. They're just feelings, and they create a sense of what I'm capable of, what I've been through, how I've been changing throughout my life. And that creates something to latch onto. It's really very powerful in meditation to get to that place where we can make contact with something that feels or registers deeper than the stories that we've been proffering to other people or the way we've identified ourselves. Because there are certain things that no matter what happens in life, no matter what happens with sickness and age and loss, that cannot be taken away. There's no amount of financial ruin or interpersonal failings or whatever I might go through that could possibly take away the things that I've contacted with in meditation. So there is deeper feelings that are available, and if we can tell them apart from the social, as the Buddha says, we will not suffer, and we'll have something to latch on. Even if you don't make contact with these a deeper identity, what you can make contact with, I guarantee, is in your meditation you can develop a sense of peace and inner calm, which is always available. And just that can present you with a state that is deeper and truer and so much less conditional and conditioned than all the stuff that we've put out in the world that we've determined ourselves to be. So that's my rather abstract talk for tonight. Sometimes you've got to go through those to get to the more easy ones. So I hope you got something from it, or at least that it brings some reflection to mind. And now it's your turn to ask any questions.